This is part six of a book on MP3 of Boiling Point, The Breakup of the United States and Its Citizens by Tom Merritt. We will start with Jeff 4. Now, someone asked on an earlier recording what the 4 was for. Each character starts the chapter name, and 4 means this is the fourth time we've seen Jeff. So part six of Boiling Point, Jeff 4. Cheyenne Reservation, Lakota Nation. The wind whipped through the 12-acre stretch of what used to be the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation near Eagle Butte. The Lakota had just completed the first three buildings in what was to be a 12-building complex. I noticed immediately upon arrival how different the place looked from most institutional buildings in the United States. The harsh badlands burst forth with green and flowers in the land around the compound. Inmates worked tending the plants here and there. The administration worked in a low green building made of glowing metal and glass. It blended into the lush landscape like a green-backed beetle. The main work hall looked something like a castle without turrets, made of adobe. Inside, inmates attended classes or created mostly practical arts and crafts. The third building, the first of the residence housing, resembled an old log cabin with chimneys on either end. Inside, the modern attributes of stainless steel and electrical outlets blended seamlessly with the wood and earth interior. It was one of the most informative stops we had made so far. Crosland had gone crazy over what I'd already sent back, but I knew it was nothing compared to what I'd shot today. After touring the compound, and then several of its many nature walks and gardening preserves, we stood relaxed in front of the administration building under the shade of a large oak tree. Faye looked back over the path that led amongst the compound buildings. Men worked at different projects with an air of ease. So the reservations are pretty much just halfway houses? Well, yes and no, White Deer eagerly began to explain. He seemed to derive great pleasure from detailing the finer points of the Lakota's governing philosophy. For many, it is halfway to nowhere, he said. Those unfortunate people drain the spirit and our budget. Many we will try to convince to leave for the U.S. Some few will be deported for actual crimes. No one who really wants to stay in Lakota Nation and who lived here before the liberation will be forced to leave. We know that lesson too well. Jeff took another shot of the inmates working in the community garden. He looked up at White Deer. Their guide had led them around the reservation for 2 hours, patiently, even enthusiastically, answering all manner of questions. All officials of Lakota Nation shared White Deer's enthusiasm. There were no evasions and rarely were questions. Rarely were questions refused. It got kind of weird, you know, having them always telling you everything like that. I wanted to catch them hiding something. White Deer was an affable, intense man, thin but muscular, about the same height as me. He had long black hair, sky blue eyes, and wore the olive green uniform of a reservation attendant. The only time he disrupted his calm manner was at the sight of the old settlement at Eagle Butte. He spoke of the horrible conditions the Sioux had lived in. Like pigs, a dark look steeled his blue eyes to gray. It was to end this and never have another Lakota or human being ever be treated like this again that the Lakota Nation arose. The rundown shacks and houses were preserved there, some with the junk and paltry possessions left intact as a reminder of what was now in the past for the Lakota. Now back in the present, White Deer smiled and seemed as much a part of the surroundings as the garden. I took one last shot. Well, I think that about does it. Thanks for your help. You've been extremely patient. It's no problem. I know what you mean, but most of us in Lakota Nation see the importance and even pleasure in explaining our country to others, especially those with open minds. In some ways, we consider it a duty. We hope the world can follow our lead and loose the earth, including humanity, from its bonds. We said goodbye, and White Deer invited us back to the Cheyenne Res anytime. We climbed in the rental car and headed down LNH 14 to Pierre. There was a good hour and a half of driving ahead of us, and we had to catch a plane early next morning. Faye chomped into an apple with gusto. Some of White Deer's enthusiasm had rubbed off. That guard was amazing! What a wonderful individual! I wanted to invite him home or something. He was just great. Yeah, he certainly was. I mean, this nation is so incredible, Jeff. Your story is so much more important than anyone realizes. I mean, this could be a model utopia in a way. I mean, I'm not saying everything is here is perfect, but they're so aware of what's going on. You know what I mean? Yeah. What's wrong? This heat gauge keeps heading up towards hot and then falling back. It's probably nothing, but it's sort of unnerving. Sorry, go ahead. No, that's all right. If you need to concentrate, I don't want to... Suddenly, a loud pop from the front of the car and steam rolled out from under the hood. I let off the accelerator quickly. I don't think that's good. Faye agreed, and we rolled to the side of the road. Should we even try popping the hood? Well, if we wait for the steam to roll off, it'll probably be fine, if the hood's not too hot. When the steam died down, I popped the hood, and Faye gingerly raised it. The engine sizzled and steamed. I stared at it. It's broke. Faye stared just as helplessly. Nutters. A highway patrol car pulled up, and Security Marshal Eagle got out. Jeff Conroy, I see you have a problem with that fine American car. Can I help? I laughed and shook hands with the marshal. Well, we can't send it back to Detroit. They seceded, you know. What do we do with this fine piece of American engineering now that there isn't much USA left? Well, that car's property of a business in the state of Colorado, which means I can't legally touch it. However, I can give you a ride back to Pierre where you can contact a mechanic to come get it. The tow will be... Do you have AAA? I laughed again. You sound as if all 50 are just happily living together still. AAA is a multinational organization, more so today. It still works here. Faye came around from the front of the car grinning. Yes, we have AAA. Okay, so the tow will be free and then you can decide what you want to do with the car. The inside of the security car was unlike any police vehicle I had ever seen. There were no mounds of sophisticated equipment or barriers or cages or anything. I found one missing piece of equipment especially surprising. Don't you have a radar gun? No, we do have speed limits, but the spirit of the law is to avoid recklessness. If I see someone driving recklessly, I pull them over, no matter what speed they are going. You see, speeding is not a money-making device for us. Some people receive other punishments besides fines for reckless driving. Any fines that are levied go to the Highway Safety Association, which educates the public. None of it goes to the Department of Security or the state. Faye read my thoughts. What were you doing out here? I don't mean to be rude, but it's an incredible coincidence. No, I was not following you. Eagle grinned slightly. I didn't think you were. Faye turned slightly red. Eagle paused. No, I do not think you did. You two are good people. I don't say those words often. I was doing a security check on the area outside the res. No one has left the res without clearance, but it's a standard check to see if anyone has lost their way. We talked non-politically most of the rest of the way back to Pierre. Eagle told us about his wife and two daughters, and I told him about the university, and Faye delighted him with tales from the animal shelter. He fascinated me with his ability to talk evenly on almost any subject whatsoever. I decided to push it a little, as I'm always too quick to do. Here was my chance to bring a little light on any sort of dark underbelly the Lakota might have. There has to be something wrong with the Lakota Nation, Marshall. I mean, everyone talks so glowingly and reasonably about how everything works so smoothly. Honestly, it's a little creepy. At first, the Marshal seemed stumped. Then I noticed him grinning. You cannot start the fire by asking the log to light, Jeff. You have not seen all there is to see. However, did you not meet Looney on the first day you arrived? Yeah. And in your studies, have you ever read of the good chief or good king surrounded with bad advisors? Okay, sure. What makes you think we're so different? But everyone involved with the nation seems to be so well-intentioned and well-adjusted. They have seen their battles and want to make a peace now. Make it work. That takes cooperation. We hope to get it by not forcing it. But then you might not get it. Of course not. But our eyes are open. Unlike the U.S. lawmakers, we do not shut off our senses and speak. We keep quiet and watch. What do you do if the whites get tired of this in a couple of years and try to take over the government? Or to make it non-racial, what if a bunch of creeps get into office? We have spent centuries waiting. A few years is not large enough to see, nor small enough to handle. I gave up. Are you sure you're not a Zen master instead of a highway marshal? Eagle laughed. You see without knowing sometimes. Zen is very important in our studies, Jeff, though not as important as the old ways. He laughed again. It filled the car with music. When we got back to the hotel, Eagle stopped us outside the car. He pulled two feathers from his shirt pocket and placed one in each of our palms. You are welcome to visit my tribe in any season. Do not feel obligated to say anything. They are feathers, merely a token. I give to friends. Thank you, Eagle. "You're more than welcome to come visit us in Colorado anytime," I replied awkwardly. Faye nodded her agreement. "If my journeys take me there, I will be sure to look you up." He smiled and waved goodbye as we walked slowly back to the hotel room. Faye looked enraptured by the feathers. "That was so cool." "Yeah." We called Croslin, who sounded uncharacteristically nervous. He told us to forget the car and get a plane back to Denver as soon as possible. "Look, I'm not making any predictions, but it'd be safer for you to get back here. If the Texans do take Denver, you'll lose everything. Possessions, bank accounts, everything. If you get back soon, you'll have time to consolidate all that. The state is helping people wonderfully." I hung up and explained the situation to Faye. She looked uncharacteristically worried. "That's worse than I thought. I didn't think the Texans were that close." "Yeah, oh, we better go. I still don't like the idea of ditching the car." "Let's sell it." Faye looked at me stone-faced. I caught the corner of her mouth start to rise for just a second. I lunged at her, but she stepped out of the way and threw me on the bed. "That's the last time you try that with me, mister." She jumped on me. The noise scared off a hawk owl outside our hotel window. It flew straight up across the moon and disappeared. Candel, 3, Tucson, Arizona. I sat in the diner, half listening and staring out the window. An owl had landed in the gravel outside and was picking at some breadcrumbs in the rocks. My thoughts pecked along with the owl. Why would Stephanie put the fate of two whole states in the undersecretary's hands? This was ridiculous. I mean, I knew I could do the job, but this was important stuff. Not two-bit phone calls to two-bit news editors to give them a four-bit workover. Shit, if I failed, it could be in part because I lacked credibility. I mean, I was only the undersecretary. Why did she want me away from Nevada so badly? She wasn't that cowardly, was she? I knew the answer. I just didn't want to even think it. Coward. I knew I better not be a coward when it came to the negotiations, which I suddenly realized I hadn't been paying any attention to. I stopped chewing and looked at the Apache chief. "I mean it." The chief looked at me wild-eyed for what reason I hadn't a clue. He seemed to go on and on about nothing anyway. Who could tell what it was this time? Wait, that wasn't fair. He was just what you call passionate, and I was just what you call depressed. "With the number of Apache in Arizona and New Mexico, there's no way and no reason we should not be independent." He grimaced for emphasis and shook his head. "I don't doubt you," I put on my most diplomatic, "I've been called on by the teacher and I have no idea what's going on," voice. "It's just that the Texas Army is going strong now, and the Lakota didn't have to face anything like that." That was good. An important point I tried to get across, I don't know, a million times, and applicable to just about anything he could have been going on about. "And what do you suggest, Undersecretary Candel?" Ow. That hurt. I stayed calm and imagined myself to be Chamberlain talking to Hitler. No, strike that. Not a good analogy. How about somebody who won? None of the diplomats ever won. Just the crazy monsters. Okay, what the hell. Ben Franklin was a bit of a rogue and talked a blue streak with the French. "A political takeover of each state. You could use peace party apparatus, but you wouldn't have to. Think with a little more work, you could do it on your own, and you wouldn't risk armed intervention from Texas, which, as I have made clear, will provoke armed intervention from California. Waiting for a political takeover would mean waiting until the U.S. is strong enough to stop us. Besides, Texas will invade anyway, whether we revolt or not. You can speed up political reform, especially if you use peace party methods, and with a California alliance to protect you," I struck the table emphatically, "Texas will not attack." "No, thank you. The lesser of two evils is California, but our Apache Confederation will stand on its own feet. Not 2 feet, but 2 million feet. He made a grand, wide-eyed gesture. I slumped back in my chair. Ding! Round 10 and match, or something like that. My last attempt to avoid war had obviously failed. I couldn't even eat. But I could drink. More coffee, please? It was no wonder I couldn't forget peace. We were eating at Denny's. We talked about other things, and after 2 more cups of coffee, I stood up, jaggedly feeling the caffeine binding tightly to my neurons. I laid a $50 US bill on the table. Nice things, those expense accounts. "That'll only cover the coffee," the Apache chief's eyes crinkled in laughter. I smiled and shook hands with the chief. "I'm still against your plans, but since you won't be moved, I hope you're right and I'm wrong." What a guy I was. Now I felt like Chamberlain. The chief nodded and the group broke up. I drove back to the Arizona Peace Party office on Congress Street and called Stephanie in L.A. to tell her that the revolt was still on for the next day. "Okay, then," her thin voice seemed far away and less than caring. "You're to hand over command to Commodore Vasquez and take up a cultural post." "Aren't you coming down?" "No, I've got a desk load of domestic affairs to handle, and Carson City still isn't wrapped." "You can't take a short reconnaissance trip? Or you don't want to?" I was bouncing around inside my ribcage with coffee jitters. "Look, Mark, I want to see you too, but until things calm down, our personal life..." "Yeah, I know, and I'm the best one for the job. Bullshit, and you know it. Why don't you want to come down here?" "We'll talk when you've calmed down, Mark." "No, listen, Steph..." I heard the click at the other end. "Hate that click. Nothing sends me off like two pots of bad coffee and that click." I put the phone gently back in the cradle and saw her picture on the desk. Suddenly, it flew through the air and hit with a crash of shattering glass, followed by several other objects, large and small, clattering against the walls of the office. I hadn't really contemplated throwing a temper tantrum, but once I was into it, it seemed like a good idea. I threw and threw and sputtered to a halt, out of breath, but the noise of falling objects continued. Thought maybe I'd started another angry fit without knowing it, but then I noticed cries and shouts adding to the clatter. I'd caused quite a ruckus. I knew Tucson was sort of a quiet town, but can a guy throw a fit in his own office without getting stormed by disturbed villagers? I opened the dirty window, expecting to see a 19th-century lynch mob with burning torches and a signed noise complaint. I was much more surprised to hear clattering gunshots. I ducked to one side and saw undefined figures moving through the streets. A police car raced down Congress Street and suddenly, almost magically, flipped over and exploded into flames as five men ran out to manage the wreckage. I felt like I was watching a bad action film, and then it sunk in that the revolt had started early and I had to get to Vasquez on the scene and order the California militia into Tucson before the Texans. I quickly dialed the Tucson, California Peace Party office. "Get me Commodore Vasquez," I barked. It's not like me to bark, but gunshots unnerve me. There was an unseemly pause. I thanked my stars there was no hold music. Finally, a voice returned. "Commodore Vasquez has been rushed to University Medical with a gunshot wound, Mr. Candell. We're waiting for orders from Blythe." I hung up and called Field General Reynolds in Blythe. "Mike, this is Candell in Tucson. You've got a shot-up Commodore and an office full of bureaucrats sitting around here while the city, it doth burn." "Well, Mark, I guess that means you're in charge. Get that unit together and either secure City Hall or make some sort of cooperative arrangement with the Apaches, whichever you think is best. We'll have reinforcements there in 2 hours. I ran out the door to get over to the CPP office. As I headed downstairs, I ran into, no, literally ran, as in running, into, as in physically buffeting, the Apache chief. He bounced off me and continued lurching slowly up the stairs. His eyes were wide open with pupils as big as eight balls. I was about to scream at him about starting the riots early when I noticed blood racing down the side of his face. He stumbled up one more step, spun like a doll, and landed in an awkward position against the railing. I kneeled at his side. "Can you talk?" A low throat clearing emptied out of the man's pale lips. "Early. I knew, but risked meeting. Very wrong." Don't try to speak." I tried to ease the Apache chief into a sitting position. Now up close, I could see the blood on his head wasn't the worst of his worries. He had a dark splotch on his vest that wasn't Denny's ketchup. I noticed three small tears in the vest, dangerously near the heart. "I want to tell you," the chief began to wheeze again, "you are brave and strong. We will cooperate. My son, Mike, he must be safe." A coughing fit racked the chief. I heard footsteps coming up the stairs, just when I didn't want them. I tried to move the chief, but had no time. A dark-haired man in Apache clothing came around the bend in the stairs and shot twice at the Apache chief before he had hardly looked at him. The bullets whistled past my left leg, grazing my instep in a blinding burn. "Who are you?" the man pointed the gun at me. Before I had a chance to speak, he fell down clutching his arm. I turned around and saw three Apaches with army rifles pointing past him. "Good question," snapped a short man with sandy brown hair who stood in the middle of the group. "I'm Undersecretary Mark Candell of the California Peace Party." I involuntarily raised my hands. I rarely had guns pulled on me, and never without my wallet changing hands. I doubt they were interested in that. "I am Mike Wind. That was my father you were trying to save. I'm honored by your effort. I have no time to get into detail, but immediately after the revolt started, a faction of the Apache Nation called Purity began to riot and demand the ouster of my father as chief. They didn't like him cooperating with the CPP even a small amount. I'm the new chief now. I'll cooperate as much as is fair. We need the CPP now because the Texans will attack. Who's in command of the California militia? Some Vasquez or someone? Yeah, could you put your guns down? Thanks. I've had a lot of coffee today. Vasquez was shot and the CM is on their way from Blythe, so until they get here, I'm in charge. I need to get to CPP headquarters now. We'll take you and set up a joint operation there. The California militia will be allowed to operate in this area as long as they don't interfere. They're welcome to help. I don't want a joint command, but I want our two organizations near to each other in case of miscommunication. Suddenly, Mike Wynn looked at his father as if trying to remember something. The glimmer of a tear appeared in the corner of one eye. Mark, will you do me the honor of helping me carry my father to the car? Yeah. Yes, of course. Mike Wynn closed his father's eyes and began removing several things from his pockets. Gehrig, 2, St. Louis, Missouri. I walked swiftly down a dark corridor. People whispered behind doors, but I couldn't find the doors. Every time I stopped to find the whisperings, a wind stirred up and nausea welled up in my chest. I had to keep walking to get away from the wind. As I walked, I tried hard to catch the whispers. Apple, delicate, stable, porcupine. That was all I managed to make out. Occasionally, the corridor twisted and turned, and the darkness would lighten to gray. Then it twisted again, and I fell back into blackness. I had the overwhelming sense that if I could just remember some key thing, I could find my way out of this labyrinth. I felt like I was taking a life-or-death test, which I definitely had not studied for. After what seemed like days of walking, the gray began to lighten even more. My steps felt more sure and familiar. I gained confidence as the whispering sounds receded and the corridors became white. Other sounds began to replace the whisperings. The light became blinding, but I knew I was on the right track. Now the brightness blinded me as much as the darkness. Instead of walking, I felt like I was floating on a soft bed of air. I felt a strange sensation in my face, around the eyes, and the whiteness intensified. A form lurked close to me on the right and said something unintelligible. I heard sounds of machinery, and the whiteness faded and dissolved into a fluorescent light. The figure loomed over me again. This time I understood the words. "Can you hear me, Rob?" I tried to speak, but my mouth had been on a 2-week cruise, and I had forgotten how to move. I nodded my head instead.
"Good. If you can try to speak, but don't push yourself."
I gave it another shot and managed the word spooky, which came out boogie.
"Good, Rob,"
the form said, unperturbed by the enigmatic word. The old routine started to come back to my mouth, and I muttered, "Where am I?"
"Well, Rob, you're at Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri."
"What happened?" I slurred.
"If you can, why don't you tell me as much as you remember?"
The form resolved itself into a 5'6" woman with short blonde hair and a stethoscope.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Dr. Katrinov." I began to tell her about the corridors and the whispering, but the memory of it seemed to dissipate as I recalled it.
"But before that, I was driving a car in Little Rock. I don't know how much I can tell you about it."
"I assure you, it's fine to tell me everything. St. Louis is in close cooperation with the Ozarkians. Here's my badge." She showed me an Ozarkian ID, which listed her as Dr. Lyuba Katrinov, MD, OPC, Medic First Class.
"I was driving a car," I continued, "and this tank came up, and Kolbrowski was looking at me funny, and I was all smiling, and the next thing I know..." "Well, I don't know anything after that. It just sort of ends."
Dr. Katrinov moved her hands over me while she spoke. "You drove into a brick wall. Your buddies all scattered out of the car, and two of them... John McGillicuddy and Mac Kolbrowski were captured by the Texans. Being knocked out cold kept you from being caught. The Ozarkians finally pushed the Texans out of the area, and you were found in a coma. They flew you here on your parents' wishes rather than treat you somewhere in Little Rock or Memphis. We couldn't detect any brain damage, but you've been out cold for days."
"Yeah, I was having this weird dream." "Man, so what happened to John and Kolbrowski? Did they get out?"
"No, Rob. I have some bad news for you about the whole squad. Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine.
I tried to sit up and failed.
Just tell me."
Kelly Hutchinson and Martin Cantrell were killed. Hutchinson on impact and Cantrell as he was trying to escape. He was shot. Kolbrowski and John weren't injured but were captured. We don't know where they are now, and the Texas government isn't talking to us.
The Ozarkian Intelligence Command has been waiting for you to wake up to see if you had any info that could give them a lead on McGillicuddy, Kolbrowski, and the others captured in that area. I'll help. I'll do whatever I need to do. I'll go into Texas if I have to. I know someone in Austin.
Slow down, Rob.
In a few hours, I'll permit the intelligence team to come talk to you after your parents have been here. But you can't overexert yourself yet.
I feel fine.
You don't just shake off a coma, Mr. Gehrig, chided Dr. Katrinov. But as soon as you're ready, the team wants you to begin working on finding Kolbrowski and John and anyone else from that unit. So get your rest and save your strength so you can do a good job.
My parents came into the room and the military conversation ended.
Kolbrowski, 5, Houston, Texas. After endless delays in what I figured out was Houston's hobby airport, the 55th Texas Shock Fighters were told the plane would be leaving San Antonio for El Paso. We hadn't been allowed to leave the plane the entire time on the ground. The captain made up some story about the plane being equipped with amazing Texan technology that would make the flight to El Paso very short. The flight took no time at all, further confirming in all our minds that we were always told lies. John began to hypothesize that the Flintstones would leave Bedrock to the east, but I urged him to be quiet. I overheard the word Halma as we landed, but the windows were shaded, and I wasn't quite sure where or what Halma was. We were all damn certain we weren't in El Paso. The captain got up and began shouting again. Okay, troops of the 55th Texas Shock Unit, you will disembark this plane and proceed no further than the water fountain at the end of the gate area, where you will await orders. You'll be put in formation as you deplane. Row one, up! The unit deplaned, and the lieutenants marched us through the airport into a bus. All references to the airport's identity had been covered, but I caught a picture of the New Orleans skyline on an ad. John saw the word Louisiana peeking out of one covered flight schedule. None of this was conclusive, it being an airport, but it made it highly unlikely we were in El Paso. The bus had covers over the windows, but once we arrived at our destination, it was obvious that the bayou we were in was not the desert around El Paso. The captain had a pair of sergeant's issue swamp gear to the troops and then shouted at us again. I'd well noted the fear tactics they used merely covered up the fear they felt themselves. I sensed this fear and wanted to drive at it, to get it, knock it down, and kill it. You are shock troops under guard of the Texas 55th Regiment. From this point on, the penalty for disobeying orders is death by shooting. We are headed into a small town to secure it from terrorists. Your job is to proceed in front of the regiment and clear out any small resistance cells that may be encountered. If you attempt an unauthorized maneuver, you will be shot. If you are ordered to do something and fail to comply, you will be shot. If you seem to be performing below your ability, you will be shot. Is that clear? Let's march.
Well, I guess that's clear.
For the first few miles, we met only small resistance cells, usually a couple of farmers with rifles. Some fired, others didn't. We performed well below our ability, missing every farmer, but the captain failed to punish. The worst scrap came when a group of about 10 teenagers armed with semi-automatics began to spray fire from the ditch. 2 prisoners and 1 regular fell wounded. Medics carried the wounded regular to a medical truck, but the shock troops were shot in the head and left behind. For the first time since being captured, the little monster inside me finally reared its ugly mug with indignity. Who were these vile cretins to waste our lives so cheap? A pox upon them! I felt the lines of Henry V and Macbeth and King Lear and others racing through my head. I was moved to action, but I held off for the right opportunity. The captain called a halt.
Bader?
Yes, Captain?
Step forward.
Bader stepped forward, and the captain pulled out her sidearm. For failure to perform in battle to your ability, the captain shot Bader through the head, dead on between the eyes.
You scabs better start aiming better.
The captain laughed, and the troops moved on. I about lost control. My 2 fallen comrades being shot while wounded and defenseless made it incredibly hard to keep control. The wanton assassination of Bader sent me over the edge. What if that had been John? Keeping my head about me had been my edge in training. Now I needed it badly. I wanted to dip my sword in the blood of their sin and cut out the vileness within them. I'd take every last one of these Texans because I know how to think, and I smelled their fear. Plans within plans formed in my mind. Ghostly echoes of more reasonable thoughts were retired to more reasonable days. My reliance on Plato, Jung, and Foucault gave way to Sun Tzu, Scipio, and Patton. After a few more miles, the unit came across a solitary man walking up the road in a gray cap, white shirt, and jeans. He seemed to be unarmed. The captain ordered a halt.
Friend or foe? Shouted the captain.
Well, that depends on who y'all are, replied the man.
We're the 55th Texas Regiment here on a mission to rescue the city of New Orleans from terrorists and Yankees.
A smile crossed my face as the captain tipped her hand finally.
Are you a friend of the South? The captain shouted.
A broad grin spread across the man's face.
Oh, yes, I am a friend of the South, very dearly. I've even heard tell there's some friends of the South left in Texas.
You don't sound like you're one of them, though, killing your own men and Texas regimenting all over the bayou.
Two other men appeared out of the ditches, a skinny white kid with a black T-shirt, camel pants, and a gray cap shoved down over dreadlocks, and a huge, broad-shouldered black man in a muscle tee with dark shades, gray slacks, and a camo cap worn backwards. The Texan lieutenants all watched the three men now. I eyed John. There was no time to plan. The opportunity was coming.
We know how to deal with threats. The captain stopped short, realizing no threat had been made.
I'm sure you do, drawled the big man.
Suddenly, about 300 soldiers emerged out of the swamp carrying well-polished, oiled guns. Some dragged along rocket launchers. Speckled throughout were men in regular U.S. military uniforms. Some wore T-shirts and others had on fancy clothes. Nearly all wore gray caps. John and I exchanged startled glances. The captain gawked.
See, we're the volunteer regiments of the Garden District, French Quarter, and city of Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
The man in the white T-shirt directed his words at the mass of men behind him.
What's our regiment's number, boys? Do we have a number, boys?
Out of the mumbling, a voice rang clear.
Oh, about 350.
And the group broke into laughter.
My name's Captain James Marlowe. You can call me Jeb, though. What we're going to do is one of three things. Now, the easiest is you're going to leave your guns right where they are and turn around and walk right back down that road. The second is we're going to take your guns and you back to New Orleans as prisoners. The third is, and Jeb's voice got louder and louder as he spoke, you're going to be idiotic and fight while outgunned 3-1, and we're going to kill every motherfucking last one of you.
And the group let loose a frightening rebel war shriek. As it quieted down, Jeb threw his final challenge at the Texas captain.
Now, do you lay down your guns? Do you submit to the army of the new Confederacy? Or do we have a problem?
As the captain began to respond, I nudged John and began walking towards Jeb. I saw them swing their 350 weapons on me and laid down my gun. There'd be time to explain later. John followed, and soon every one of the shock troops had laid down their guns and walked over to the side of the Confederacy. The Texas captain yelled, "Halt!" over and over, and was turning to give an order for the regulars to apprehend us when one of the regulars let loose and fired. Before either captain could stop their squad, a barrage of fire began, and the two armies retreated into battle formations. The shock troops, caught without guns, dispersed into the swamp. John and I took off, running low, stopping every 10 feet or so at gunpoint to explain who we were and what we were doing. The Confederates had no idea the shock troops were prisoners. They got even angrier when they found out. They let us go, but wouldn't give us weapons. We ran for an hour. Eventually, we were no longer stopped at gunpoint, but had to leap to avoid corpses littered here and there. Obviously, this wasn't the first action Marlowe's unit had seen. The battle dimmed in the distance. We walked into what looked like an old garage. We moved cautiously and found absolutely nothing but dirt. No old papers, no odd antiques, no trash. It didn't matter. We were exhausted and slept almost instantly upon hitting dry ground. The sun mercifully set and graced us with a moonless, anonymous sleep. And that is the end of part 6 of Boiling Point.